Well, it's such a simple idea, but then successful TV formulae usually are. And even my children have been gripped by this one. But Channel 4's Come Dine With Me eavesdrop on a group of four or five people who host a dinner party for each other on successive nights. And they mark each other at the end of each evening. And the one with the most marks, who's produced the best sort of hospitality and entertainment and food by the end of the week, the winner gets £1,000. So, you know, it's fairly cutthroat and merciless and gripping television. And in fact, the more excruciating the conversations, the more gripping the TV. That's what it's designed to be. It thrives on lumping incompatible people together and then sitting back and just watching the fireworks. Well, tonight we have reality TV from 2,000 years before it was even dreamt up. Because what we've got tonight is a dinner party with the most excruciating of moments. It's said that if you want to succeed in polite British circles and climb the sort of social ladders of British society, you should never talk about religion, sex, or politics at dinner parties. Well, tonight, this dinner party is one at which all three pretty much get discussed. It is absolutely excruciating and very painful to watch. And yet, it has the potential to change lives. But what went wrong? Well, first of all, look at who's involved in our passage. We've got a Pharisee, a preacher, and a prostitute. That is not a very promising combination for a sort of effortlessly smooth dinner party. Not least because the prostitute has gatecrashed the party and hadn't been invited. So this has all the makings of something excruciatingly awkward and one of those sort of moments that only sort of British sitcoms know how best to milk. Now, I think we can get a sense of our host, Simon the Pharisee. We see in verse 36 that he's invited Jesus to supper while he's passing through. And I guess you know the type of Simon is. I suspect he did this sort of thing all the time, don't you? Any dignitary or notable passing through the town would be sort of, well, of course you must come for supper. Do come along. Network and meet some of the local great and the good. It would be lovely to have you. I'm sure it'll help you in your work. You can just imagine the sort of patter. And I suspect Jesus was just another in a long string of society guests that he was only too pleased to welcome into his house. But what Simon couldn't have expected was that one of the local not-so-great all good, would pitch up as well. You see that in verse 37? When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, well, she just had to be there. She wasn't going to miss this one. So uninvited, she barges in with all this sort of appropriateness of a strippogram at a royal banquet. Everybody knows who she is, which begs the question of how they know who she is. But that's another story. But as soon as she walks in, the atmosphere has completely changed. As the guests sit their aperitif, you can feel their scorn and condescension, can't you? How embarrassed Simon must have been in front of his honoured guest. How awkward. But it gets worse. Because you see, it's not just the woman's behaviour that scandalises Simon, although that was bad enough. You know, where did she get the funds to pay for this expensive perfume in the first place? Well, we all know where that came from, don't we? Her ill-gotten gains. Well, look at verse 38. She brought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. I mean, this is excruciating to watch. But you see, it wasn't just what she did that scandalized Simon. He was actually more scandalized by his honored guest, Jesus. Because you see, Jesus seems to do nothing about it. Just on Thursday afternoon, I was sitting on the train just coming into Waterloo, and it was the day after the nightmare of Bigotgate. And whatever you might think about what happened when the Prime Minister was caught in a very unfortunate situation after his gaffe, it was very depressing, I thought, to see how quickly people were to get all self-righteous about it. But there were a couple of teenage girls across the aisle from me on the train, and they were just chatting. I didn't quite hear what they were talking about. One of them asked her friend a question, and her friend immediately patted her lapel jacket and said, "Wait, I just need to take my mic off for answering that one." It's amazing how quick these things become part of the sort of popular culture. But I suspect we're all the same, really. We'd be mortified if people knew what we were really thinking half the time, don't you think? Which is why we're so mortified when things inadvertently slip out. But the problem for Simon, you see, was that Jesus actually did know what he was thinking. As we see in verse 39. If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. Simon's shocked and appalled in only the way a self-righteous snob can be. Don't you see how she's touching him? Doesn't he know what a day job is? As far as polite society is concerned, sinner is far too polite a word for her. But here's the irony. See, Jesus does know what kind of woman she is. Precisely because he is a prophet, and yet that doesn't put him off. He knows all about her. But he handles the situation with characteristic brilliance. Sure, it had been embarrassing for everybody else, perhaps, but it wasn't embarrassing for Jesus. He seems to know the woman already. No, it's not what you think. Yes, he knows her, but it's not what you think. They've met before. And as a result, there is a deep and profound friendship. But there's nothing scandalous about it, as we will see. But it's fascinating how Jesus doesn't lay in for Simon either. Did you notice that? He takes a very different approach. He doesn't get all snooty with him either. Instead, he just tells a story. I mean, just imagine it, can't you? I mean, Jesus' friend quietly weeping at his feet, Simon silently red-faced and fuming, and everybody else at this dinner party hanging on Jesus' every word. What's he going to say? I mean, this was a real train wreck of a dinner party, wasn't it? Everything had gone really wrong. And let's just, before we look at the story, just remember who we're dealing with here. There's his host, Jesus' host, a man right at the pinnacle of the local social society, right at the top of the ladder, respectable, religious, impressive, genial, hospitable. And then there's Jesus' friend, this woman at the bottom of the ladder, disreputable, downtrodden, embarrassing, scandalous. Each would have known their place, and Jesus should have known his place. If Jesus had been truly religious and upright, well, he should have spent time with the former and kept right out of the way of the latter. But that's not how Jesus did it. He doesn't seem interested in ladders and pecking orders and social or religious or anything else. No, he takes people as they are, which is a surprise, isn't it? I bet if you did a straw poll of people out there on Regent Street and Oxford Street and asked them what they thought Christians were like, I think you could make a pretty good guess of what people would say. I wouldn't be surprised if words like judgmental came up, or self-righteous, or superior, or yes, dare I say it, bigot. And you know what? Many Christians are all of those things. There's no use denying it. It's true. But Jesus? No way. That's not the way he is at all. As we see quite clearly in this episode. So why is that? What makes Jesus different? Well, there are lots of reasons. For one, I think he refuses to identify people with their reputations, good or bad. He's not conned by the spin. He doesn't listen to the gossip. He takes people as they are. He couldn't care less what is said about this woman weeping at his feet. He treated her as she was, a human being, a friend. But does this mean he didn't care about the life she'd been living? Not at all. How people live matters a lot to Jesus. It's just that Jesus, unlike Simon, believed that people can change. That's the difference. He believes that people can change. Now, it's one of those words. It's a cliche, especially at election times, isn't it? People preaching about, speaking about change. And for those who've been around, seen this election go and many others go too, it can seem rather a threadbare word, can't it? And of course, a national mood and a national direction can change, and you know, there's something in that. But there is a cynicism about politicians around, because many people assume, well, they're all the same. Doesn't matter what party they're from. They're all the same. That's the line, regardless of their designs or hopes for public service. I think that's unfair, but it reflects a fear that many share. People out there, they don't really change. And we think that because if we're honest, we think, I can't really change. That's what I fear most, deep down, that I'm actually stuck. Well, Jesus disagrees. He does believe that people can change, and in fact, he's proven it. And this is what this story is about. He tells a little story to make the point. It's a simple story, very simple, very down to earth. Two men needed some cash. Pretty everyday story, isn't it? We're not told why, that's not the point. They just desperately need some money. And they're so desperate that they're willing to risk borrowing from a loan shark. One takes 50 denarii, another takes 500 denarii. Now, one denarius is about one day's wage. So basically, one person's borrowing sort of 2 months' salary, the other one more than 2 years' worth. Now, who knows what the interest rates were on top of that, but whatever they were doing, this was risky. Getting into such debt like this, it's rather topical at the moment, isn't it? How on earth do you get your way out of this sort of debt? But we must get the point of Jesus' story. It's quite clear. Both men were in debt. Both men were in trouble. Both men were unable to pay their way out. That's the point. Neither of them, as he says in verse 42, neither of them could pay their way out. Now, what would you expect next? As soon as they sort of, well, you know, most loan sharks, I think they can probably see it in people's eyes when people are struggling to pay back, don't you? They're used to it. What do you think is going to happen next? A little aggro? Send the boys round? A little doing over with a few baseball bats? That's what's coming next? I guess these two who borrowed money knew what could happen. But this is when they discovered that their loan shark was actually no loan shark at all. Look at verse 42. He cancelled the debts of both. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine what that must have felt like? Both now rescued. Now, did either of these two deserve it? Well, not as far as we can tell. In fact, not at all. Both were in a deep hole and profoundly unable to dig their way out of it. Their only hope, I guess, had been to just sort of hope against hope, to cling to straws, to hope that something extraordinary might happen. But of course, extraordinary things never happen, do they? Not in the real world. I've been an addict of West Wing for years, and my family and I, we used to live in Uganda, and there wasn't a lot to watch on TV, so basically we must have watched several seasons of West Wing over several times, I think all the way through. But anyway, there's a great moment in one of them where CJ Craig, the press secretary, is chatting with a rookie reporter who's on his first day in the West Wing. And she accidentally slips that somebody is under special investigation, federal investigation. And she immediately realizes that disclosing such information is in fact a criminal offense. And she's petrified. She hives off into an office, she slams the door shut. She's too scared to tell anybody. But this, knowing what she's just done, eats away at her, it gnaws away at her. And she can't sleep, she can't work, she can't think straight. She even becomes obsessional about going to the gym, which to my mind clearly proves she's not thinking straight. And she just cannot think about anything else. Her agony is only removed when somebody's actually guessed what's happened. Don't quite know how, but you know, this is a fiction. This is stories. But someone guesses anyway, and puts her mind at rest by explaining that she'd actually misunderstood the law and that she was all right. She actually hadn't done anything wrong. But the relief, I mean, it's brilliant acting, but the change that comes across CJ's face in that moment. In fact, everything about her, her whole body seems to change, and it's instant. The joy that comes of the relief after that sense of profound dread. Now, of course, CJ hadn't done anything wrong, as she discovered. What did she have in that instant? And in fact, when we come back to the story of these two debtors, they are in trouble. They are out of their depth. This is beyond their control. They are stuffed. Until this person who loaned them the money forgives the debt, cancels the debt, and says it's okay. You don't have to pay. That relief, that joy is something like what these two debtors must have felt. So the big question in verse 42 that Jesus asks is a very good one. Which of these two will love that person more? Which will love them more? And Simon's answer in verse 43, I don't think it's begrudging. I think he's just seeing the point. He says, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled. Yeah, you're too right. Jesus says, you judge correctly. Now, both men would have been pleased, of course. Both men have been in trouble. But 2 years' salary, now that, trying to pay that sort of money back is a tough call. And Jesus' point? Well, it actually explains what's going on at this excruciating dinner party. It explains the difference between his reception from Simon and from his friend. Her behavior was clearly over the top. Clearly over the top. Jesus doesn't deny that, but what did Simon do for him? Nothing more than the standard demands of society etiquette, and not even really that. But she washed his feet with tears and her hair. She didn't stop kissing and pouring expensive perfume on his feet. Way over the top, and yet devoted. Simon just politely shook hands without sincere affection or even love. Light years of difference between the two, don't you think? Why was that? Well, the clinch is there in verse 47. I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven. She loved much. That's what all this proves. She loves much. But he who's been forgiven little loves little. Do you see the point? Why is she over the top? Why is she so devoted, so overwhelmed? Well, it's easy. It's her relief and her joy. To apply the little story he told, it's as if her debt of 2 years' salary has been cancelled. So yes, you see, Jesus did know her. He knew all about her. He knew her very well indeed. And yes, he did know what sort of life she'd led. But he believed that people could change. Now what is the catalyst for change? What is it? What is it that brings about such change? Well, I can tell you, it's not pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. It's not trying to be a better person. That can do nothing about the past. You might be able to present a better facade or do a bit better and be a sort of genial, nice person, but it doesn't change the inside. But people try that, and it doesn't work. No, the catalyst, you see, the catalyst for true change is there in that magic word. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is what can turn a life around. Forgiveness changes everything. You see, it means I don't have to be a slave to my past. I don't have to stay stuck. And to realize that, the relief, the joy, the liberation. Now that's why she's over the top. She couldn't care less about what anyone else thought. Who cares what they think? This is what Jesus has done for me. He's turned my life inside out and upside down. And I'd do anything for him now. And I'm not embarrassed to say it. And that's why Jesus accepts it. In fact, he's thrilled by it. But perhaps you're thinking, hey, come on, that's too easy. I mean, that's just so naive. Forgiveness, is that all? Can anybody forgive? Be forgiven? I mean, Christians bang on about forgiveness a lot, but they don't really seem that different very often, do they? And to be frank, I would agree. But the fault lies not with forgiveness, but the feeling that perhaps there's not that much to forgive. You see, that's the problem. And I think in the end, that's Simon's problem. You see, he thinks he's different from this woman here. He thinks he's better than her. He thinks he's morally superior. And as far as polite society was concerned, I guess they would have agreed. That's a fair assessment on the surface. But Jesus knows Simon's heart. He knows what he thinks, as we've seen. He knows all about Simon's angers, his snobberies, all his cruelties, his selfishness. And even the fact that actually on a day-to-day basis he lives more for himself than he does for his God. You see, it's perhaps surprising, but reality nonetheless, that religion, doing religious things, can actually be a convenient mask to a life lived without God. A life lived without God is not so much denying God's existence. Actually, I don't think there are many people in this country who actually deny God's existence. But there are many people who live as if he didn't exist on a day-to-day basis. Even those who go to church. You see, religion can be a convenient mask to hide what's really going on inside. And that actually is rather a dangerous thing. It's dangerous, you see, to think that actually I can sort all this out myself. If you think like that, you will always be rating yourself in pecking orders. It's natural. You'll always be comparing yourself to other people, making yourself feel a bit more comfortable, a bit more secure by the knowledge that actually that person, that woman, that man is inferior to you. You'll always be like the runner who constantly keeps tabs on where the arch rivals are in the race. You see, in Simon's mind, he was doing fine compared to this prostitute. But if you think like that, you will never seek forgiveness. You won't do it. You'll assume you don't need it. Yeah, I've done a few things wrong, but not seriously. And if you don't need forgiveness, you'll never show true gratitude to the forgiver. And you'll never understand the behavior of the forgiven. Let me say that again. If you think, like Simon, you'll never ask for forgiveness because you'll assume you don't need it. And if you don't think you need forgiveness, you will never show true gratitude to the forgiver. And you will never understand the behavior of the forgiven. They'll think it's over the top, not appropriate, not the dumb thing. Which sums Simon up to a T, doesn't it? Despite his religiosity. He can't bear this exuberance from this friend of Jesus. He doesn't want any of it. And that is in large part, I think, why the final stage in the story is so scandalous. Because you see, as much for the dinner party guest, I think, as for his friend. In verse 48, Jesus says to her, "Your sins are forgiven." I think he said that to her before, perhaps when they first met. But he's saying it to her now so that they all know what's going on. You see, this bringing of forgiveness lies at the very heart of Jesus' mission, despite the scandal that it caused. I mean, many people questioned, who's he to be able to forgive sins? I mean, only God can forgive sins. Sin is about a life lived without reference or dependence on God. It's an offense to God, which means that God is the only one who can forgive it. And Jesus says, no, your sins are forgiven. Which is why faith, which is another word for trust, why trust in Jesus is what counts. Which is why he can say in verse 50, your faith has saved you. That's the clincher. That's what changed everything. Faith in Jesus as the one who can forgive. Trusting him to bring forgiveness. Because he can and does and longs to. It's why he came. It's why he died on a cross. You see, just as the two men in Jesus' story were genuinely in debt, yes, they did have problems. They couldn't get themselves out of it. So, with this woman, she was genuinely in trouble. She was guilty because she had lived a life without dependence on God. It wasn't so much the lifestyle as the very fact that at her heart she was not living depending on God. Which is actually, ironically enough, what made her on exactly the same level as Simon. But the way she lived was not the end. It didn't mean that she was beyond hope or beyond forgiveness. She simply came to Jesus to find it. And that changed everything. It changed her. But when he says to her at the end there, in verse 50, go in peace, you know she's not going back to that old lifestyle. You know it. Because she's utterly devoted to him. She knows he has given her everything. Utterly devoted to him. And so should we be. It's something we Christians need to be reminded of frequently. I mean, perhaps you have a Christian friend whose behavior leaves a lot to be desired. Well, simply ask them, haven't you been changed by Jesus' forgiveness? Call them up short. Doesn't Jesus' forgiveness mean anything to you? Don't you now want to give everything to him? He gave everything to us. But perhaps it's true that you carry around with you a colossal weight a sense of guilt and regret, a sense of running away from God, a sense of living life by your own rules, not His. Perhaps you don't think about it all the time, but every now and then, at those sort of wakeful moments in the early hours, the burden of that deep frustration with yourself. And you think there's nothing that can change this. There's nothing that can take that ache away. Well, I want to say, it doesn't have to be like that. Change is possible. Because forgiveness is possible. Because forgiveness is true. It's a reality in Jesus. And that's what this wonderful story reminds us. And that's what the singer of the song I'm about to play to you is getting at. He's a man called Piers Pettis. He's from the States. And he sings a song about offering something for the pain. Offering something for the pain. The pain of living in a suffering world. And he gives one or two sort of thumbnail sketches of what makes this world confusing and agonizing at the same time. And yet he also touches on the reality, the pain of living with the reality of our own guilt. And what lies behind what he offers, there's something for the pain, is precisely what we've been talking about. It's this offer of forgiveness. So the key is what Jesus says to her in verse 50, those wonderful words, your faith has saved you, trusting Jesus for that forgiveness. And if we come to put our faith in him, we will hear those wonderful words, go in peace.